Okay, now it works. Okay, then everything is fine. Now it's working. So, with a quarter of an hour delay, then welcome again. And now let's start this lecture. I apologize for my voice. It's a little bit of a cold which I caught, and I hope it will not catch you, but there's luckily a little bit of distance between me and you, and hopefully I do not transport the viruses and too far away. Anyway, so last time we looked at how to translate functions, and so the only thing which now is missing, so here is the code which we generated for the factorial function, and we argued in particular how the value 5 here is can be computed, which is the the maximal amount of stack space used during a single call to the factorial function. So what's missing now is how to put all the bits and pieces together to translate a whole program. So for a whole program for the code of a whole program, first we have to agree what are the initial configuration and program execution starts. And so we kind of I find it reasonable to assume that then the stack pointer has value minus one, because it cannot point to a topmost memory cell, there is none. And the same for frame pointer and extreme pointer. That the PC is zero, we start with a zeroth instruction, and that the new pointer points to max. So the memory cells available are from zero to max minus one. So max points to NP, points to the topmost, least occupied memory cell. Non-memory cell is occupied, so therefore max. So then what how would the code look like? Yes, please. We could also use null. That would be another choice. But I thought it does not refer to any existing memories. Occupied memory cell, and there is no memory cell, so therefore minus one. That is a choice. It's not so that it is a law of nature that it must be. You could have a reasonable machine also by pointing it to zero, because at least for us, a stack pointer memory says zero, at least during a run of a program, should not contain, should not be referred to. So then the code for a program should consist of a program consists of we may assume that the program consists of variable declarations for the globals and then function definitions, where one of the functions is the definition of the function main, and typically we assume that the last one is main. And here we also kind of ignore the case that some of these function definitions are not really definitions but only prototypes. In order to make a name available, we could consider prototypes not really as function definitions but just as kind of directives to modify the address environment. So then, thinking of that, then the... What should the code then be? Clearly, the code should consist of the definitions for the functions. It should provide code for the allocation of globals. And it also should provide code for an initial call to main, because that's the kind of convention. A program execution starts with an initial call to the function main, where in the real C, this main function has parameters which are fed from the input, from the command line input, and we, for simplicity, we ignore that. One could also, one can write C functions also, C main functions, also without parameters like that, but typically it has parameters taken from the standard input. That would be the main function, and then we have everything should terminate with an instruction halt. And we have already discussed a little bit this instruction halt. This instruction should return control to the operating system outside the virtual machine. And now, if thinking again of the semantics of C, the main function may have a return value. And what happens with that return value? The return value of the main function is handed over to the operating system as kind of information whether computation has succeeded or not. And so, therefore, we might extend the halt function in that way that it takes the content of one particular memory cell and hands it over to the operating system. And for that memory cell, we now could choose anything. For example, the memory cell with address 1, but, well, I used the memory cell with address 0 because that has not been used otherwise and we cannot access it from inside the C program, but at the halt instruction could access it and hand it over to the operating system. So again, this is just a convention. It is not mandatory. You could write C interpreters or C virtual machines for C, which has another has another convention here. Okay, but with these conventions, the code would look like as follows. So here are the definitions of the functions, and then at the very first address, at the very first beginning of the code, we have to place the code which should always be executed, because we program execution starts at zero, at address zero, and address zero can be considered to be here. So therefore, the code here at the beginning can be considered as the code for a call to the initial call of the main function, where clearly the main function, at least in our simplistic world, has no arguments. Still, we allocate here more space, and this space which we allocate here in the beginning is the space for the globals. Again, our world is a little bit simplified. In C, you could have initializers for the globals also, initializing them by 5, by 6, by some constants, and we do not have that here. Otherwise, we would have to create code for it in order to not just to allocate the memory for it. So that, therefore, in order to deal with the globals, we have here this allocation, alloc k plus 1, why k plus 1? And not k, if k is the size of the globals. The size required for storing the globals. Why k plus 1? Because according to our convention, the stack pointer before program execution is minus 1. So the first one is added to arrive at 0, and then we add k, and so that occupies then the memory cells 1 to k. For the globals and conceptually leaving the zeros memory cell free. And then the enter kind of has to take care of how much extra stack space might be required. Yeah, so how far can the stack pointer go outside the call to the main function? Outside the call for the main function, the extreme pointer only has to take care of the space required for realizing the call of main. And for that, we have to take care that beyond the global variables, We additionally have to provide. We have to push three organizational memory cells, and that is, yeah, and that's it. Yeah.
There's a 4 and not a 3.
What?
It says K plus 4 and not K plus 3. But,
but it says K plus 4.
Yeah.
Because the topmost memory cell occupied by the globals is the memory cell with address K. So enter K plus 4 adds to the stack pointer before the before executing of that. So here at that point, we have SP equals minus 1. And then this enter thing adds K plus 4 plus minus 1 and sets the extreme pointer to that. And this is K plus 3. Okay? Because enter, once again, the instruction enter takes the stack pointer as it is and adds a certain value to it, and here it is the value k plus 4, in order to compensate for the minus 1 of the SP before at program start. Okay? And then comes the alloc, which kind of sets the stack pointer to... and then the alloc sets the stack pointer to k. And that means that kind of is the topmost memory cell, occupied by the globals, and then we have three memory cells between extreme pointer and stack pointer, and these are exactly occupied by the mark, will be occupied by the mark, followed by this loading the constant the start address of main, and then the call, the following call will kind of replace the start address of main with the old PC, the instruction where execution continues after the call of main. What should happen after the call of main? After the call of main, in the memory cell just below the organizational cells, which is the memory cell with k, in that memory cell the return value of the main function is stored, and then comes this slide k. This slide k will then move this value into the memory cell with address 0. And then comes the instruction halt, which halts computation and returns the value which we have moved into this memory cell with address 0. Okay, is there a question? So it's just what we, again, this code is not made for being maximally complex, but to be as simple as possible and just to realize the semantics of the C program. And then the code for the further functions declared within the C program, they will be kind of accessed or called through the body of main, as usual. By that, you do not modify the stack pointer, but only modify the extreme pointer. Therefore, the stack pointer afterwards is still minus 1.
Ah, okay.
If you would do it the other way, first modifying the stack pointer, and then modifying the extreme pointer, then the enter would be different, clearly. Because then one would have enter 3.
Ah, okay.
Yes? That was kind of what you kind of had in mind somehow.
Okay,
so this finishes the chapter on C. and we now may want to look at other programming languages. And the next programming language, at least the second important class of programming languages, are the functional languages. so I'm just a little survey. Who has ever used a functional programming language? who has never written a program in a functional language? None. So everybody knows. So did you like it? Who liked it? Okay, so some people liked it. Who hated it? So why did you hate it? Please louder. Because of the many opening and closing brackets. But then you programmed Lisp, had to program Lisp. Because in modern functional languages, there is nothing like an overwhelming mass of opening and closing brackets. In OCaml or Haskell, you barely see any brackets. I will kind of explain it soon. Now you're, what did you say? Yeah, that is, yes. Okay, so that is your complaint that the code is so succinct that it is hard to see what it really means. That is a particular problem of Haskell, which has the very many extremely powerful mechanisms. And it is kind of, yeah, so in this sense it's a baroque language. We will here not look at such baroque constructions, but use a kind of pidgin OCaml language. So was there another kind? What kind of things? What did you hate about functional languages?
I don't know. It's about functional languages, but I hated network programming for functional languages.
Okay, so network programming for functional languages might not be so easy, but one advantage functional languages have, which is only now. Appreciated by object-oriented programmers, namely they have functions as first-class citizens. So that is a useful thing. And in particular, even if you do reactive programming or so, you always have these callback functions. And so even if then you leave the realm of pure functional programming, which is a little bit academic anyway, but if you at least have always these, you can use functions freely and then kind of store them at some places for callbacks, for example, making things a lot easier and much less heavyweight syntactically as perhaps in object-oriented languages. Yes, please. Nothing is opposite, so all real languages are kind of a mixture of different features. So C has also functions, but functions not in some sense as first-class citizens. So in some sense, also OCaml is a multi-paradigm language. Haskell tries to be kind of very purely functional, but then also people have tried to use Haskell for I think even web servers and things like that. And at some place, you have to interact with the real world. And the latest at these interfaces, you have to do something. Okay. So here now, let us kind of briefly review this fragment. So now we go for a fragment of a language, and this POOF language should mean pure functions. And so that is for the moment we try to kind of capture what is typical for functional languages. To make such a language realistic, you have to add to a certain amount of destructive updates, to a certain amount kind of I.O. and things like that, without which you hardly can do any meaningful programming. But here we kind of concentrate on this pure function part, which in the syntax of OCaml, but otherwise not much is, so you would find it in any language. So for the moment we are even more simplistic. We do not only rule out side effects and things like exceptions. Later we will have exceptions. Later we will, I don't know, either in the lecture or in exercises, we will look how to realize side effects. And we also will look later in the in the lecture we will also consider simple data structures. So what is the key data structure which people have in functional programs in any functional language one might conceive?
Lists.
So that is kind of the basic data structure when you kind of build, and one might think, this is a stupid data structure, you cannot do very much with it. This is true. But on the other hand, it's so simple, and it's kind of for quick and dirty implementations when it is not necessary to have a sophisticated data structure, lists are good enough in many cases. Okay, so here is the syntax, and you see it's minimalistic. It fits into six lines. So the first, let us see what it is that, what we have there. So the first thing which we realize is that in a functional language, at least in these pure functional languages, everything is an expression. So there is no distinction between expression and statement. So everything returns a value. There's nothing which does not return a value. Statements, we learned, will not return values. They leave the stack pointer the same invariant. But this is here not the case for functional languages. Everything returns a value. Okay? Now there are very simple expressions like constants, single variables, or operator applications. So these kind of expressions look familiar to us. We had these kind of expressions also in imperative languages. There's another thing, which the next thing is also conditionals. As there is no statement, conditionals also must be expressions. So this means if E1 holds true, E0 holds true, then the value of E1 is returned, otherwise the value of E2 is returned. But it's all an expression. In some sense, this is a feature which is also provided by C. As you all know, there is this question mark colon operator, which exactly is this one. Okay? So up to now, thus we have seen nothing specific. So the next thing which is of interest is, which is important and makes functional programming in some sense interesting, is that one has function application. So function application you also have in imperative languages. If we write f applied to 1, 2, 3, then we have a function application. The only point is, and that is kind of a little bit distinctive, this functional programmers, modern functional programmers, try to avoid brackets as much as possible. And if I have a function, and if I apply it to an argument, I just denote this by juxtaposition. So this brackets around the argument is kind of considered useless for functional programmers. And so therefore we kind of have taken this point of view also when we wrote down our code generation schemes, which were kind of cases of a function written in a functional language. Yeah. So functional programmers try to avoid, but perhaps they have learned the lesson from Lisp, they would try to avoid these brackets and write it like that. When a functional programmer writes a function like that, what does he mean by that? He means f is a function which is applied to a single argument. And the single argument is a tuple of three things. So functional programming languages typically also provide the concept of tuples. So here in this minimalistic first setting, we will consider tuple later. For the moment, we will not consider tuples. We will only have ints. But later, we will also add tuples. But in this sense, this is a this here is a function f applied to a single argument which happens to be a tuple. This is kind of a slightly different view to such a thing which we have also in imperative languages. So, but when you write But when you write F applied to 1, 2, 3, 4, what does that mean? Yes, so f is a function taking multiple arguments now, not just a single argument. But these are kind of these four arguments which are applied one in a time. So f is a function, you can supply the argument one to function f. If you do that, if you write this one, this is a function which is, this returns a function which still is able to consume three further arguments. Namely a 2, a 3, and a 4. This is kind of a partial application. And only when all four arguments are there, the function will fire and will start to execute and then return some other result. Okay? Therefore, so if one wants, in this sense, wants to have a multi-argument function, so you could also, if you want to have full bracketing, you would write the full bracketing in this way. To indicate f first is applied to 1, then the result is applied to 2, then the result is applied to 3, then the result is applied to 4. Okay? But somehow, from a compiler's perspective, it is more efficient to have in mind that it is not one argument applied to the other, but these four arguments are already there. And therefore, we will kind of be happy if the programmer decided not to use these brackets and leave them out, and that would allow us to generate more efficient code. That we will see later, because then we see or have all these four arguments which are supplied at once together, and we can kind of pass them as parameters on the stack. That would be kind of in one go, and this is cheaper. So therefore, this would kind of, if you have a compiler with these properties, this should kind of appeal or kind of mean to the programmer that he or she should better avoid brackets whenever possible. Okay, so that was function application. By the way, you could also write it like some things like that. This is again a little bit of an exercise. Now, this is a function with three arguments. The first argument is a pair, the second argument is the number 3, and the third argument is the number 4. Yeah? And you could also write it like that. Then you have a function with two arguments. First is a pair, second is also a pair. Just to kind of get you as a warm-up so that you all feel now familiar, that here's nothing strange, so we really try to do what goes on in functional languages. Okay, so that was function application. Now there's another thing, that you kind of can create functions, and that create anonymous functions. So in imperative languages, you always have to give a function a name. You cannot construct something without a name, but here, in functional languages, you can create functions without a name. For example, if you want to have a one-time function, which is only stored away in some place, then you could write it in this way just directly. So, and that function has a function body, which is this expression here, and it has parameters which are provided here. And then you need some kind of keyword, and in OCaml the keyword is fun. And the arrow here is to separate the parameter list of the body of the function. This kind of thing, what is the keyword in Haskell? They don't have fun there. What do they write?
Maybe
death.
Maybe death.
No. I thought, but maybe I'm not very good at Haskell programming. Don't they simply write this one? It's kind of a lambda. And that then comes to the parameter list. Or have you never written anonymous functions? Okay, never mind. Okay, so so this is a function, and now you might Now, this, at some point you want to introduce a name for a variable. And that is done by, there are two constructs. In OCaml there's a let and there is a let rec. In Haskell they have kind of merged these two together. There's only a let, which also could be recursive, and they leave it to the compiler to find out which definitions are recursive definitions and which are non-recursive definitions. Because non-recursive definitions can be treated more efficiently than recursive ones. That we will also see later. For the moment, in OCaml, we have these two kinds. So here, what does that mean, kind of intuitively, and as a recap? So here, the name x1 is introduced, and it receives a value. And the value of e1 is an expression. This is this e1. This could be a function. It could be also a constant, or another variable, or any other expression. Okay? And the the x1 here, is it a variable like in an imperative language? That is my question to you. The answer is no. In imperative languages, a variable is a name of a container. And it has a content. Here, a variable is a name for a value. And this means it cannot be updated. Because a value is a value is a value. Yeah, so it's not a container where you can put another thing into it. If x1 is 5, then x1 is 5 forever. The only way how the x1 then can lose its value is by going out of scope. So if nobody refers to the x1 anymore because perhaps another x1 has been introduced, then the old x1 name is gone together with its value. That's it. Okay, so that's the simple principle of functional programming. Now this, therefore, scoping of names is very important. Now what is the scope of x1 in a let? Well, the x1 here can be used in the body of the let, in the e0. So the e0 may use the x1 as often as it wants. And there you have the x1. And when you are outside the let, the x1 is gone. So that variables or names have scopes, we have seen in imperative languages as well. But in functional languages, you have a much more refined concept of scoping. And you have to keep track at every point in time what is in scope and what is out of scope, what went out of scope. Yeah, in particular, since you may have nested definitions. So nested definitions, you do not have very much in C. You could have nested blocks, but that's kind of, we ignore that a little bit. And you could have even in modern, I think starting from C99, you have these local function definitions. Has any of you ever used local function definitions in C? Okay, so you see there might be scoping, but people don't use it very much. I don't know whether Stefan has already given you an exercise for these local functions, as I told him he should, because that's a nice thing to reason about, to just to think about. Okay, so that was this let. Now what is the difference to let rec? So in let rec, this is if you have many names which could be mutually recursive. So an x1 depends on x2 and x2 depends on x1. So that means that the scope of the x1, x2 and so on is not just the body, but it's all the other expressions here as well. So all of them together are the x1 to xn are visible and can be used in all of these expressions of this inside this let rec. This is a big difference. And this makes the translation a bit more complicated here. Which?
What if I have a circle of the use of this variables?
What do you mean? Something like that?
For example, or if I say in I use in E1, EN and EN, I use E1.
You can write it down, and that's it. So what do you want to have once again?
Well, in E1 I use EN, and in EN I use E1.
So your program is let rec E1 equals E2 and E2 equals E1, and then you have to say something like E1. This one? What will happen? So it depends. Well, no, actually it does not depend. So the first thing which we note is that, and we will come back to that, I will come back to that later, so whether it's called by value or called by name. In OCaml, you would first try to this is a recursive, you would kind of try to evaluate this one, and in order to get that, you will try to evaluate that one. And, and that comes back to that, and it would not terminate. If it is not already rejected by the compiler, because it's kind of a stupid program. So it would not terminate. If you have a Haskell program, it wouldn't evaluate lazily, so it would start with that one. It would not start with the right-hand sides, but it would start with the X1 and try to evaluate that. And in order to that, it would go here and find, in order to that, I have to go there, and then it goes there, and then it returns to X1 and also would not terminate. But that would be the ordering in how the variables would be evaluated. Okay? Does this answer your question? So it would not terminate anyway. You need it. The syntax says that you need this in thing. It's not an and, so sorry. That was kind of, you are probably right, or that is, if you complained about that, it should not be and here, but in. Sorry. Okay, so that was a little bit about the syntax and already a little bit about the semantics. And one more thing, which I kind of said, but I would like to repeat it once again, and that is, for the moment, we only assume that everything has type int. And that also, for simplicity, and that means we do not have Boolean values. Any functional language, I don't know whether this is also true for Lisp, but at least any serious functional language has a separate type, bool, or Boolean. And this is distinct from int. And then a conditional should return a value true or false, and not 0 or 1. But here, for simplicity, I kind of found it would be perhaps simpler if we just have one type, int, and just use the C convention of having 0 as false and everything else as true. But this deviates clearly from OCaml. In OCaml, we would have true and false. Okay, so here comes another realistic example of a piece of code written in this tiny language. Actually, it is more or less the only program which you can write, because we only have ints, and what can you seriously compute with ints? So here's what you can compute, the factorial function at least. And you must compute it in a recursive fashion. In a recursive fashion, and please note that I kind of allowed myself the freedom for this example I did not allow me the freedom. I just used it really programmed it in the minimalistic way, provided by a fragment of a programming language. This means we define a recursive. We provide a recursive definition of the name fac or factorial, which is used here in the body of factorial and also here in the main body of the definition. And the factorial itself is a function. We define it as a function having the formal parameter x, and the body of the function says, please check whether x is less or equal to 1. If so, return 1. Otherwise, return the product of x times what factorial returns for x minus 1. So that would be the factorial function in a functional language. And please note, there's no return statement or something, because we have no statements. It's just an expression and that we write down, and then the value is computed and returned. And we call the whole thing for the value 7. Okay? And you see here that no parentheses at all are required for this kind of program. Well, not really. There are only parentheses here in order, because function application binds stronger than arithmetic operations. That is kind of the general convention in functional languages. And since we have to kind of first subtract and then apply the function, we kind of have to insert brackets. So only in these dubious places we insert brackets. The rest is done by bracket conventions. This also means that this kind of operations bind stronger than the if construct, so therefore no brackets. And the if construct binds stronger than the arrow operator for functional abstraction, so therefore no brackets there. So it's that there are no brackets is just because of these bracket conventions. And if one had, I think some modern Lisp dialects also have bracket conventions, and then you can save a lot of these brackets. Okay. So this is this story. And, in some examples. Yes, please. Factorial function. So that is, that I said, x is the formal parameter of the function. And the body of the function is this one. So a more conventional way to write it down is to write the formal parameters. You can also write on the left-hand side of the definition. So put the x here. Then you can save this one. And then you only have the body of the function to the right. Often, also functional programmers write it in this way. But you need not. This other notation is also always there. Perhaps not so often used by beginners, but you can use it nonetheless. Okay? So that would be kind of the alternative way of writing down the function. our compiler will consider this as syntactic sugar and will put x on the other side. Because for our compiler, a let rec introduces names and not functions. And we deal with them as if they were names. And for functions, we create values, because a function is a value. And therefore, we put the x to the other side to create the value for this function. Yes, please?
Why do we need let rec here and not just let?
Because it is a recursive function. In Haskell, I said, you use always let, because they consider everything as recursive functions. Or they kind of leave it to the compiler to do the optimization. But here, just to follow the OCaml style programming, we have the specific rec. Maybe you kind of have your program with ML, with SML. They have a different convention, and that is exactly like you kind of asked about. If the function only depends on itself, then they also kind of avoid the let rec. But that is very specific, and here we Once again, we follow the O'Connell way of thinking, and so we have to write let rec if something is recursive. So that is this, and now comes the next point of view, which I already indicated a little bit when it came to your question for in which order variables are evaluated. And that is, again, you should know about that, but I will kind of, again, as a recap, make it explicit. There is call by value, and there is call by need as parameter passing conventions in functional languages. Haskell has call by need. O'Connell call by value. And call by value is call by is the same parameter passing discipline which we know from C. This means you first have to evaluate the arguments of a function to a value, and then you pass this value. This is call by value, as everybody would have guessed. Yeah? Now call by name. Call by need, sorry, it's not call by name, it's call by need. that is not stated here, but N stands for need. This means that Haskell is suspicious. It always assumes the programmer writes something down, although it never will be evaluated. And it only decides to evaluate it when it's when there is no other way. Yeah. So that means if this x minus 1 will not be evaluated, it will be passed as an expression, if you like, to the function factorial. And then only when the function factorial decides, oh, I have to look at the x in order to determine whether it is less or equal to 1, only at that point, the expression, the argument, the content of the formal parameter will be evaluated. And that is kind of, in some sense, you might say, oh, this is a stupid thing. If I pass a value, if I pass something as a parameter, I am quite sure that I want to have it evaluated because otherwise I would not have passed it. And that's true. And therefore, the worlds of O'Connell and Haskell programmers are quite orthogonal, and these people, although using both functional languages, do not understand each other. Sometimes they even fight ideological fights. But both of them have their strengths and their weaknesses. For example, this is not so much the case when you have ints, but this is much more the case when you have data structures like lists. You can write down a list of containing infinitely many elements in Haskell. This is no problem, as long as you only look at finitely many of them. So that is, you can use a style of programming where you use generators, which kind of create anything of a kind, for example, all primes, and you have kind of consumers, which then take the list generated by a generator and consumes of it as much as it is required. And then the consumer decides how many primes will be computed and looked at. So in that sense, this is a valuable and interesting paradigm of programming, which is possible in Haskell. It's not so easy to do the same thing in O'Connell. Okay? So that's these two kinds of parameter passing modes. Now let's go to the now we proceed. We want to construct a virtual machine. How do we do it? We just do the same thing as we did for the C machine. We come up with an architecture for the virtual machine, and an architecture is just a minimal set of data structures to maintain all values, all runtime values, and then come up with a bunch of instructions which operate on these, which realize the semantics. That's all what we have to do. And again, these instructions we will produce by and by introduce by and by. The only thing which we kind of have to start with is the very basic data structures. And one of these very basic things is we need an array for the code. And this is exactly the same as for the C machine. And one cell of the code array will contain one instruction, even if the instruction has extra arguments. And so this is the code store, the C, and we have a PC. This is also no surprise. This PC shows the next instruction to be executed. So in this sense, now you see what you have learned was not just for nothing. We reuse our ideas as much as possible. And also this means if we want to have, we have functions, and this could be recursive, so we probably will need a stack. And so we provide a stack. So this stack we call S, very familiar. And each memory cell also contains, is able to hold a basic value or a pointer. Yeah, and there's a stack pointer pointing to the topmost occupied memory cell. This is this SP. And we have a frame pointer pointing to the stack frame of the current procedure or of the current function. We have only functions. Yeah? So this is also the question how the frame looks like, how the frame is organized. This we defer to later. But there will be a point somewhere in the frame which will be pointed at by the frame pointer. Okay? Is there any question to that? It's not at the start, so in the beginning. During program execution, it points to the topmost memory cell. This is the same as in the C machine. So here's nothing with minus one. Where do you see minus one? That is another story. What about the heap? So in the in the world of the C, we had another data structure here in the same array, which grew from the other direction. For the C machine, we take another point of view. The there is will kind of, this is kind of an a promise. There will be no address arithmetic in a functional language. So the memory management will be so kind of canonical that we will even have a garbage collector for it. And so therefore, we consider we will realize the heap in a separate data structure, which is maintained as an abstract data type. And so here we simply do not care how this abstract data type is implemented. We could implement it in any way which is convenient for us. For example, by just a block of memory where you allocate certain memory, like one segment of memory where we allocate certain blocks. But we will have, and later we will speak about how to organize that, because we will have garbage collection there. Any functional language comes together with a garbage collector. So, but that means, well, let me just finish with that. There is no such thing here. Now your question. So the same is here.
Yeah, but why do you have this number? I thought that in general in C, for instance.
So I consider it is a stack, and the stack grows. And somehow the what people use for the in the on the physical machine, that they that the stack shrinks somehow, or the stack pointer shrinks when the stack grows. So I think since we have the free choice here, I decided that way. So there is no other reason. Okay? There's no other reason. So here is the heap data structure. So the heap is kind of, you can consider it really as a heap of things. And the only question is what kind of things will be in. So the main point of thing, the main thing is that all elements in the heap will have a tag. And the tag tells what kind of thing it is. This is different from C, where you have kind of a contiguous memory, where you have memory cells, and you navigate in it, and it is to the programmer to know what currently a pointer points to. Here we have a tag which we can inspect. Yeah. So now the question, and then we have values there. So that is also one component of the elements. These are the tags. Then we have values like 1, 2, 3. They can also sit in the heap. That is like in think of Java integers. These are also int values which reside in the heap. And on stack you have a pointer to it. And in fact we will have the same convention here. That values, typically all values, will have a representation in the heap. And the stack only refers to these representations by means of pointers, or references actually. So this is in some sense like in Java, where you are, besides the basic types, everything there sits in the heap and you refer to it by references. This has the advantage that all these values, from a stack point of view, have the same size, because each of them is nothing but a reference. And this holds also for objects in Java. They all have kind of the same size, namely a reference to some memory blob in the heap. Okay? So the key issue here is to have these heap pointers. And so heap pointers could sit on the stack to point to values, but also if you have structured objects, structured elements in the heap, then these could contain pointers to other heap objects, like objects in Java. They could have fields, and these fields could be other objects, meaning these fields may hold references to other places in the heap. So these are the pink fields here in the little picture. These are these heap pointers. And sometimes we will also store code pointers in heap elements. These are, I've indicated here, as black. So these are the minimalistic constituents of the elements in the heap. Now let us see more concretely what kind of elements we will construct. The first thing is we will construct basic values. So these, the tag, and as I said, every element has a tag. So basic values are characterized by some tag saying that it's a basic value, and this is the B. And so it could contain number. Then we could have another thing which might be useful, which is a function. As I said, functions are first-class citizens. These are values. They must have a representation in the heap. And the now what kind of representation should it be? If you think of C, if you represent a function there, it is just a code pointer, and that's it. In in functional languages, typically this is not so easy, and this is due to two reasons. The first point is that there could be global variables, and so you kind of have to provide the values to the globals, otherwise you will not be able to evaluate this function. So these global the values of the global variables will be collected in a vector. So here is a vector, which I will explain in a minute. So this, but that means that a function must provide also the values for the globals, which which is contain a reference to a vector. And then it could be, as we kind of pointed out, in this little experimenting with this F and the list 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, that there could be a function could be applied to a sublist of their arguments, say to one or two arguments. Then the result is again a function. And somehow you have this functional object, therefore does not only have to provide the code pointer, but also a vector of those arguments which have already been provided. This is the argument pointer, which is this beast here. Here. in red perhaps. So here there's an argument pointer and there is a global pointer. And both of them point to vectors. Now a vector, what is a vector? A vector has a tag, this is this f, and it has a length, because there could be vectors of different lengths. This is written here, and then it's a collection of references to other elements in the heap. So this means, as I said, values kind of from an on the stack would be just references to representations of these values in the heap. Therefore, this vector of would also contain just these references. So there are no numbers 1, 2, 3, 4 in this in a vector, but only references to basic values containing 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? So these are kind of things which we kind of, with a little thinking, you would have kind of dreamt up these things yourself also. Now there's one more thing which we kind of have to introduce, and we will use later. This is the concept of a closure. As we have discussed a little bit, when it came to call by need, we said, oh, Haskell will not evaluate the argument when it is passed to a function right on the spot, but it will kind of postpone to evaluate it. But how can I postpone the evaluation of an expression? Well, I have to kind of collect all relevant information required for evaluating this expression and kind of encapsulate it into something. This something is called closure. And this closure needs to have a representation in the heap. And this is the C object. And so this closure then is stored, when a closure is created, it is this C element is stored in the heap, and the reference to it is returned on, is put onto the stack. So this means later, when you look at a value, you need, for example, the value of the formal parameter to check whether it is less or equal to 1. And then you have to take this reference and have to check, is it evaluated? That is, does it point to a basic value? Then I can just retrieve it. Or is it not yet evaluated? Then it points to a closure. And then the closure must provide me with all information to do the evaluation, which is technically a code pointer, where the code for the expression, to evaluate the expression, is stored. And, well, the expression may contain variables. So these, the values of these variables are kind of collected in a vector, this global vector. So these two things are encapsulated into the closure, and at the place where you evaluate it, you jump to the code and use the global vector to access the variables inside of it. We will see how in detail how this works, but here's just to give you the intuition why these objects are needed. Okay? And now perhaps one more thing concerning closures. If you compare a closure to a function, it is so not so much different. In a certain sense, it's the same, only that a closure is simpler in that it has no argument pointer, because there are no arguments. In this sense, a closure is something like a function without arguments. From an implementational point of view, it is like that. Okay? Any questions to these heap objects? Okay, then for realizing this abstract data type heap, we need... What is a null pointer? There is no null pointer in C, in functional language.
What does a function have as an argument point or pointer if the function has no arguments?
Ah. You mean the question is what happens if I have f of this one? Yeah. That is kind of a question. the question is, how do we represent this beast here? And for us, in OCaml, this is an element of a... this is an argument. This is an argument from the of type unit. And that unit type has only one element, namely, it's kind of like a tuple of length zero. So you have this unit, this value of type unit, which you pass to the function. So in that sense, the function has an argument. And the type of this function, so if it returns int, then the type of this function would be unit to int. So in this sense, every function has an every function, if it is an function, has an argument. Okay, does this settle your question?
Yes.
In order to manipulate the heap, we need kind of instructions on the how to the minimal instruction which we need is, we kind of must be able to allocate a new element in the heap. And then I thought, well, we use kind of a new thing, like in object-oriented languages. So there's a new instruction, and then the new receives that needs to know the tag which is created and the arguments which are stored in the object. So these are kind of listed then. So, for example, if you want to create a new closure, then you would write new C, and then you need a code pointer and a global pointer. And the result of it, of this instruction, when executed by the runtime system of our virtual machine, then memory in the heap will be allocated, and this corresponding heap object CPGP will be stored there, and a reference to it will be returned by this new thing, and then you can take it and put it onto the stack, for example, or store it somewhere. Okay? So that is kind of everything which I know about the heap. It should be simple enough. Now let us see what kind of... once again, consider the C machine. There we had kind of code L, code R, and code, depending on whether we have L value to compute L values, R values, or whether we have a statement where there's no value to be returned on the stack. Also here, we kind of consider several forms of several code-generating functions for an expression. We consider that the most important one is this one, the code V. This should translate the expression E into a sequence of instructions which computes the value of E. Now the question is, okay, the value of E is computed, but where is it put? And the default is that the value is put into the heap, and the reference to it is returned on top of the stack. This is should be the result of code V for E. So code, once example, code V for the constant 1 should create a basic value with content 1 in the heap and return a reference to it on top of the stack. This is code V. Okay, now comes code C. This is the second important thing. That is required for example, for Haskell. For code V, for code C, you do not want to create code which generate code which evaluates E, but only you want to have code which only constructs the closure for E. That's the code C. Yeah. So when you run this code, there will be no evaluation. There will only be construction of the closure. And this closure will be put into the heap and the reference to it on top of the stack. So these are the two most important things. And now comes an optimization. And as an optimization, we provide a third code generation scheme. This is this code B. The B stands for basic, basic value. Because if we have to do, say, arithmetic, if we have x plus, or simply think of 1 plus 2, if we use code V for the 1, then the 1 will be constructed in the heap and the reference returned on top of the stack. If we do the same for 2, then we have another basic object in the heap and another reference on top of the stack. But now we have to add them. Okay, we could use a strong addition operation, which takes its arguments as references, retrieves their values from the heap, and adds them. But somehow this is inefficient. So it is better to kind of use it different when we know for this expression that its result will be the argument to an arithmetic operator. We directly create the value on the stack. Yeah, so this is an optimization. We could create it in the heap and then just retrieve it from there. But if you already know that that the result should be on the stack, then we directly construct it on the stack. And the same for the 2. And so this is the code B. So the code B, once again, evaluates the expression E, produces code which computes the value of E and returns it on the stack and not in the heap. Yeah, and this clearly makes sense only for basic values and for no other values. Okay? So, that means whenever we kind of have a programming language construct, we will in the end have to provide these three code generation schemes. But we will not provide them all at the same time. We will start with the very simple ones, and see how to deal with them, and then we go to the more complicated ones. And we will not look at all expressions at the same time, but we start with the simple expressions, and then which are as familiar to us as possible, and then continue with the more complicated expressions. So that is, the first thing which we look at is at simple expressions, which are built up by constants and arithmetic operators. And we look only at the B scheme. And then you should realize that then code generation is exactly the same as for the C machine. Yeah, when we have to create a code for a constant B, then we just load the constant on top of the stack. And if we have to apply an arithmetic operator, we first create code for the argument, the code B for the argument, and then apply the unary operator. And for binary, the same. If the result is expected on the stack, we first compute the value of the arguments on top of the stack, and then we apply the operator corresponding. Yeah, so this one should correspond to that. Okay? So that's it. Now that's all. That is all easy. There's only one particular thing which is strange here, and that is that we have an extra argument here. This SD. SD stands for stack distance. And the stack distance kind of keeps track how much the stack pointer has changed. Recall that we can do that for every broken point statically. We did that in order to determine the extreme pointer as the maximal deviation of the stack pointer from the start, from the situation where it was before the call of the function to afterwards, to that place. And that we will keep track. And that means here the stack distance before the code for E2 has increased by 1. Why? Because the value of E1 has been stored on top of the stack. So therefore there's an increase by 1, which we keep track here. Okay? So that should do it for today. Tomorrow we skip the lecture, because as we have this kind of possibility of skipping lectures, because it's only a 3 hours lecture, and kind of it's good for my voice anyway, not to give to speak too much at the moment, and I hope to be recovered next week again, and then we meet again on Monday. Thank you very much.